First sight, Genesis chapter 49 appears to be rather an obscure chapter with not a great deal to say to the contemporary Christian, but in fact it's one of the finest and the most important passages in the Old Testament, since it enshrines the destinies of the 12 tribes of Israel. And so this extraordinary chapter 49 with its blessings really encapsulates 1,500 years of Jewish history from the time of Jacob right down through the Exodus and the redemption, through the kingdoms of David and Solomon, right down to the coming of Jesus Christ, which of course is mentioned in connection with the tribe of Judah, the forerunner of Christ, 1,500 years later. And so you see, it is a chapter which deals with family destiny. And one by one, the boys are summoned up. Of course, the boys are the progenitors of the clans of Israel, the tribes of Israel, and a blessing is pronounced on each head. Now, it's interesting that if you take the leisure to read through these blessings, you find that the blessing is usually tied to one of two things: either to the past history of the boy concerned, or else to the geography of the bit of land in which he's going to settle when he gets into Palestine. For example, Simeon and Levi, in verses 5 to 7, are censured and condemned for their past history, the pogrom that they carried out on the village that had violated Dinah, their sister. Jacob didn't want revenge, you see. Jacob was perfectly prepared to marry the girl off to the offending man. But Simeon and Levi wanted vengeance. They had weapons of cruelty in their hands, and so because of their past history, that blessing is pronounced upon them. Also in the case of Reuben, in verses 3 and 4, the blessing that comes on his head doesn't seem to be much of a blessing, but there you are. The pronouncement on his head has to do with the fact that he had defiled his father's couch in chapter 35, and so the pronouncement has something to do with history. But in the other cases, the saying on the head of the boy has to do with the geography of the Holy Land. And in fact, I believe that the land is the real clue to this interesting chapter, because Palestine, you see, is rather a special land. It's a land that's hedged in. And on the one side, you have the Mediterranean Sea, of which the Jews were afraid, because the Jews didn't like a sea. Whenever the sea is mentioned in the Bible, it's mentioned in rather fearful terms. The Psalms are full of the raging of the waves. And the waves are thought of like as the nations in rebellion against God. Genesis chapter 1, darkness is on the face of the deep. When Isaiah looks at the sea, he sees it as a kind of parable of the wicked. He says the wicked are like a troubled sea that throws up mud and dirt. There is no peace, saith my God, to the wicked. They're like a sea. John, in the book of Revelation, looks at the sea and he sees great monsters coming out of the sea of humanity. The tyrants and the dictators who have terrorized the earth, they come from the sea. And so it's a kind of picture, you see, of the world of evil, the world without God, the world in rebellion against God. And so Palestine, you see, on one side is hedged in by the Mediterranean. And on the eastern side, it's hedged in by the River Jordan, and away beyond that, the unattractive desert. And so you see, Israel was in the land for a purpose. She was hedged in by God for a divine purpose. If she went south, she landed in Egypt. If she went north, she fell into the hands of the pagan empires, the godless empires, Persia, Greece, Rome, and so on. And so you stayed in the land, and you were hedged in for your divine destiny. But even inside the land, the soil was different. And so you have geographies inside the geography. All sorts of geographies inside the Holy Land. If you read George Adam Smith's great old Victorian classic about the Holy Land, you've got the coastal plain, very narrow. Then you've got a little plateau called the Shephelah Plateau. Then you've got the highlands. The people who live on the plain are not like the people who live on the plateau. The people who live on the plateau are not like the people who live up in the hills. Down in the south, you've got the Negev, the desert. People who live in the desert are not like the people who live in the mountains. There's the well-watered plain of Jordan, very lush, very fertile, very green. You can see its greenness from the air as the plane comes down into Lod Airport at Jerusalem, the well-watered plain of Jordan. The people who live there are very different from the people who live in the desert. And so you have different geographies inside the geography of the Holy Land. And I think that this great 49th chapter of Genesis teaches us as Christians two very important lessons. And the first is this, that we should always learn to covet the best things for our families and our children and our relatives. We should learn to covet fruitfulness for Christ, for our children, and for our children's children. I wonder, for example, if Jacob was really coveting the wrong things for Ephraim and Manasseh. He seems terribly preoccupied, not only in chapter 48, but also here in verses 22 to 26. He seems terribly preoccupied with material possessions, don't you think? I know he speaks about the blessing of heaven above in 25, and the blessing of the deep that couches beneath, whatever that may mean. And then he goes on, you see, blessings of the breasts and of the womb. He just wants them to grow in size rather than in quality. Now, we should always learn to covet the highest things and the best things for our loved ones, whether they be our relatives or our children. And it's interesting, some of the commentators point this out, that quite a number of the tribes in their history turned out to be rather fruitless. For example, the tribe of Dan, which in verse 17 is viewed unfavorably as a serpent in the way, a viper by the path that bites the horse's heels, and so on. The tribe of Dan produced only one great man in its history. The man was Samson, and he had a very checkered career. The tribe of Benjamin, little Benjamin in verse 27, which again is viewed unfavorably. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf, in the morning devouring the prey, and at evening, in the evening, dividing the spoil. It's also true that the tribe of Benjamin produced only one great man, and he was Saul. And like Samson, he had a very checkered career. And so it is, you see. In fact, I would say that the most of these tribes were, on the whole, not fruitful tribes. the really fruitful tribes were the tribes of Levi that produced all the priests, and the tribe of Judah that produced all the kings. David and Solomon, oh mercy, over a thousand years after this, the godly King Hezekiah with his reformation, after that the godly Josiah with his reformation or revival, and of course Judah produced the greatest man who ever lived, Jesus Christ, born of the Virgin Mary of the tribe of Judah. And I'm sure that there is a lesson here for churches and families and for individuals. I think that if you look at the churches in Scotland today, you'll find it's the same churches who are producing the goods for Jesus. It's the same churches who produce ministers to preach the gospel. It's the same churches over and over and over again in Scotland that are producing missionaries for the field. And by and large, it's the same churches over and over again that are producing money for the Lord's work. Now, this is something that exercises me greatly, because this has been a very fruitful congregation, at least in terms of producing ministers for the Lord's work. But our brother James is the last of the line, dear friends. Is there anyone else going to hear the call of God? How many young Christian girls have we produced for the mission field abroad? Well, only one, really, and she comes for Huntley. Moira Campbell's not an Inverness girl. Same churches, you see, producing the goods for Jesus. And what's true of the tribes is true of the churches, and what's true of families, what's true of churches is also true of families. You can go through some of the Christian families in Scotland, and there's a wonderful history of fruitfulness for the Lord in the families. If you know the history of the China Inland Mission, as it used to be, it's now the Overseas Missionary Field, the Guinness family, wonderfully fruitful, generation after generation after generation of consecrated Christian people, 100% for Jesus. I think of the Tallaght family in the Free Presbyterian Church. Their name seems to pop up all over the place. Wonder why. People who pray, you see. Grannies who pray their grandsons into the ministry. Grandfathers who pray their granddaughters onto the mission field. Wonderful. Look, have a chat with some of your Free Presbyterian friends and ask them to tell you the history of the Tallaght family. Absolutely wonderful. Our own Tom Torrance can tell the same story, and in fact has told it in Life and Work, that he is the end product of generation after generation after generation of godly Christian people. He was born in China, of course, where his people were missionaries working for Christ there. His brothers are all in the ministry, and they all the women in the family, they all marry ministers. They say that the weddings in the Torrance family are like presbytery meetings, just crawling with ministers. Absolutely wonderful. Why? Because if you go back through the generations, you'll find fathers and mothers and grannies and granddads who prayed their children into lives of consecration. And if you read Professor Barber's interesting life story when he became a moderator, wonderful what lies behind that man. I like him. Sorry that he's not coming to Inverness, Simon. In my moderatorial year, I would gladly have had him here in the West Church, because I think he's a fine man. Well, you see, his roots, one generation back, were United Free, which was a gospel church, you see. When the Alkirk was deed, the United Free was still preaching Christ. And then, of course, he says, But way back before that, in my great-great-grandmother's time, we were all free church. They came out of the disruption. Praying people, you see, who prayed their families into Christ and into Christian service, if you know the history of the Salvation Army. It's the same story, you see. There was, William Booth, to start with. Then there was Catherine Booth. Then there was Bramwell Booth. And then was the Marischal. Do you remember, anyone remember the Marischal? Wonderful. Godliness in a family. Speaking to my friend Roland Moss, who's a geography lecturer down in Birmingham, and he used to say it was exactly the same story with him. He could scarcely think of a relative who was an unbeliever. And when he was a boy, he was a Christian, he believes, almost from the day he could breathe. He never remembered a time in his childhood when Christ wasn't in the house and wasn't in his heart. Even as a wee boy, 3 and 4 years old, Christ was there. Christ was natural to him. And he grew up with Jesus Christ. Of course, there are always problems, you know, when you come to grow up, your teenage years and puberty and all that, struggling with life and meaning life and so on. But he had Jesus Christ all the way with him. And Jesus Christ was so natural in the house. Parents used to speak about Christ as if he was in the room. Prayer was made to Christ. The scriptures were read. Jesus Christ was just alive in the house. A fruitful family. Now you see churches, tribes, families. Other churches and tribes and families produce nothing. Is it rather like the parable of the soils? Of the four soils in Christ's story, 3 of them are barren. One is fruitful, 4th one. And of the one that's fruitful, a third of it produces only 30% fruit. Another third produces 60% fruit. And another third produces 100% fruit. Of course, we should always try to make for the 100% fruit for our children. We should always covet the best and the very highest for our families. Second thing is this, that Christians, under the call of God and under the sound of the gospel, it is our duty to enter into our destiny wherever God has put us. If you turn to the map now, it's a bit dicey because it was all done in a terrible hurry. I want you to see where the tribes settled. They're all in different environments. That's very important. Starting at the southern end, when Israel came up from Egypt, of course she wandered for 40 years in the wilderness, and that whole generation died out in the sand. And then they come to Edom. It's interesting, they come up the eastern side, you see. The first nation they meet is relatives. The Edomites were descended from Esau, had the blood of Esau in their veins. Moving northwards, you come to the great plains of Moab. That's where Ruth came from. Jesus is not choosy about his relatives, as you've so often heard me saying. Ruth was a Moabitess. And therefore, along with Ammon, a little further north, was descended from Lot by the incestuous union with his daughters after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And yet Ruth, you see, is claimed as an ancestress of Jesus Christ. So God's nae fussy about his relatives. And hallelujah for that. You'll notice that Reuben settles on that side of the land, almost outside the land. The Jordan is a kind of natural boundary. And if you compare the settlement of the tribes with their prophecies in Genesis 49, don't have time to do that now, of course, there's time to do it at home, I'm sure. Reuben just disappears. He's a baddie. And eventually he was swallowed up by Moab. He was overrun by Moab. Moving further north through Ammon, Gad settles there, an unimportant tribe, doesn't seem to produce anyone. You're in the land of Gilead there, rather fertile sort of area, the balm of Gilead, Jeremiah. Is there no balm in Gilead? Is there no physician there? And the Negro spiritual, of course. There is a balm in Gilead to heal the sin-sick soul. Moving north, rich farming country, the bulls of Bashan, still famous for beef cattle, way up there. Further north, you're moving into Syria, with its capital Damascus, not Assyria. Assyria was an empire with the capital of Nineveh. That's where Jonah went. But Syria, a nation, had its capital as Damascus. Still there, of course. It was on the way to Damascus that Saul was converted. Moving westwards, you come to Mount Hermon, which you can see always when you're in the north of the Holy Land, perpetually covered with snow, the snows of Mount Hermon, glittering in the sunshine. Very beautiful indeed. Moving westwards, you now come to the land of Phoenicia. Syro-Phoenicia, Phoenicians, great seamen, of course, they even came to Britain. They found Phoenician remains in the south of England, beads and jewellery and beakers and so on. Very rich country. Tyre and Sidon, the two main ports, that's Jezebel's country up there. Israel was always fascinated by that area because that was the door to the worldly empires, the culture, rich culture that the Holy Land it didn't have. And so poor Dan, away in the north there, is exposed to the pagan empires and is gradually corrupted. Moving south, before you come to that range of hills, you find yourself in Galilee, the highlands of Galilee. That's where Naphtali settles. The reference in 49 to breeding blue blood fawns up in the hills. A clan, a mountain clan, with lots of intermarriage and interbreeding and so on, blue bloods. Also Issachar, bowing under his two burdens and selling himself for tribute in there. You notice that he's on, well, just above the hills there is the valley of Armageddon, the plain of Armageddon, or Megiddo. Very rich and fertile, as it still is today. If you go there as a tourist, you'll see how rich it is. The wells of Harod, where the men stooped down to lap with their hand. Do you remember the story of, is it Gideon? Yes, it is. I think it's Gideon. The ones who drank and the ones who knelt and the ones who lapped with their hands and so on. Well, that very fertile area with springs and so on is just in there. That's where Issachar is. Issachar liked the good life and apparently sold himself for material possessions. Zebulun and Asher are near the coast and were also corrupted, really, because, of course, they're near the sea and therefore they're near civilization and they're near the empires. And so all those northern tribes very quickly disappear. Then there's the mountain range. Moving south, you come to Manasseh, son of Joseph, and further south, of course, Ephraim, his brother. In between, there is the capital of Samaria, which became the capital of Ephraim, or Israel, as it was called, the 10 tribes that broke away. You notice that down from Samaria I've put Shechem. Now that's where Joseph is buried, actually. His mummified body was carried from Egypt all the way through the Holy Land, and he's lying there. He's now under a Muslim mosque, never mind. And just to the north of Shechem there's Mount Ebal, and just to the south is Mount Gerizim. One is the Mount of Blessings, and the other is the Mount of Cursing, and all Israel stood there, you see, with the blessings on one side and the cursings on the other side. Then there's the long valley, between Ebal and Gerizim, right up, and right at the end of the valley you can see the mountain of Samaria, where Jezebel lived, with the ruins of her palace still sitting on top of Mount Samaria and ringed with vineyards. Very lovely. So Manasseh and Ephraim, the fruitful tribes. Also I've put in there Shiloh, which is where the ark first rested. That's where the tabernacle first rested when it came to the Holy Land. Not Jerusalem, of course, but in Shiloh. That's where Samuel spoke to the Lord. That's where Eli ministered to the Lord in Shiloh. It was eventually destroyed. You'll notice it's up in the hill country, and the plateau starts there, called the Shephelah, slipping down towards the Mediterranean Sea. Moving further south, there's little Benjamin, also the ravenous wolf, remember, way up in the hills, rather a wild tribe. Then there's Jerusalem. Then there's the main tribe of Judah, the Lord's tribe, the kingly tribe, with just south of Jerusalem, Bethlehem. Further south is Hebron, which is where Abraham is buried. Further south is Beersheba, still associated with Abraham and the patriarchs. To the west are the Philistines. The Jews tried not to go too near the Philistines with their cities. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 Philistine cities. And right in the south, it's Simeon settling just on the borders of the Negev. Now, is there a message there? I think there is. It's this. Geography breeds character. And character breeds history. And history breeds destiny. I have a pyramid here. Geography, your surroundings, your environment, the mountains, the hills, the seas, the rocks, the moors, all that stuff that surrounds you, where you live, they breed character. Why do you think the Scots are dour? Why do you think the French have panache and fire? Why do you think the Arabs are indolent, so that you can hardly get an Arab to do a decent day's work? The taskmasters are all going around, always going around with sticks, whacking them to get some work done. Why are they like that? Geography breeds character. And character, because it's the stuff that we're made of, breeds history. That's where the battles and the wars and the kingdoms and the empires come. They come out of men's hearts. They come out of men's characters. Hitler, Mussolini. It's because they were the men they were that they produced the history they produced. And of course, human history produces human destiny. It's a pyramid. Geography makes character, which makes history, which makes destiny. Let me give you one or two illustrations of this. The tribe of Naphtali was a highland tribe. Well, what are the characteristics, generally speaking, of people who live in highlands? And this is true, not just of Scotland, but of all the other highland places. Well, there's a fondness for tradition. There's a conservatism. Don't care for new things. There's a suspicion of outsiders, a little bit. And there's a marvelous spirit of hospitality once they get to know you. Now, these are the characteristics of mountain people. And it wouldn't matter where you go in the world where there were mountains. That's the sort of thing you find. Fondness for tradition, slightly suspicious of outsiders, and given to the most marvelous hospitality once they get to know you. It's certainly true of the Highlands of Scotland. If you go to the Highlands of Brittany in France, exactly the same. If you go to the Pyrenees, the south of France, exactly the same. And if you go to the mountains of Moravia in Czechoslovakia, absolutely wonderful. Traditional dress, traditional costume, traditional manners, traditional speech, a bit suspicious of outsiders, but once they get to know you, they will destroy you with their love and their kindness and their hospitality. Geography breeds character, character breeds history, and history breeds your destiny. Let's come nearer home. Here's another example. The Murray Coast, where I was brought up, wasn't born there. What's its history? Well, a history of revival traditions of a rather superficial nature. Frothy gospel meetings with Sankey hymns and redemption hymns, and you get a bit emotional and excited, and the preacher says, come forward to the altar and make your consecration, come forward and get converted, a little shallow and tending not to last very long, and the converts tend not to be interested in the deeper things of Christ. They just like the gospel, what they call the simple gospel, as if the gospel wasn't very profound as well as simple. That's the Murray Coast tradition. It's died out a bit, but that's the tradition. But the storms of the Murray Coast and the bitterness and the hardship and the poverty in which many of them grew up have bred in those people with their love of shallow revivalism a solidity of character. There is a rock-likeness of character, and they can laugh at the storms. They laugh at the storms, and they laugh at the storms of life, because the hardship has bred character. And that's why so many of the fishermen along that Murray Coast are so hardy and so tough. The geography bred the character. The character breeds history, and the history breeds destiny. Now, some of the fishermen tell me that what intrigues them about going to England when they go down to Yarmouth and Lowestoft is this: that in England, the fisher people are not godly. It's the farmers who are Christians in England. Isn't that interesting? The fishermen sometimes used to come home from Yarmouth or Lowestoft or from Grimsby in days of spiritual blessing and say, oh, I don't know, these English are half a hard, they're not interested in the gospel. Whereas in Scotland, the fishing people tend to be Christian, and the farmers tend to be uninterested in Christian things. The country areas in Scotland are amongst the deadest areas spiritually. Whereas down in England, it's the farmers who are Christians, and the fishermen are not. Now, up north here, you see, it's the hardship that has put character into the people. Another example, not to weary you with examples. Southwest Scotland has a character all its own. Glasgow, Lanarkshire. Now, what's the characteristic, speaking in general terms, of the people in Lanarkshire and the southwest of Scotland? Immensely warm, marvellously generous people, full of the rough and tumble of life, tenements, you know, and tenement stairs and stairhead fechts, you know, all of that rough and tumble, but with a marvellous compassion, very compassionate, warm-hearted people, so that in the days of the old tenements in Glasgow, when one person in the street died, the whole street went into mourning. All the blinds came down. Sense of community. Sense of compassion. Sense of caring. What bred that in them? Well, it was their geography. You see, the trouble with Glasgow is, of course, a very beautiful city. Go down the back streets and see some of the lovely Victorian buildings. There's a heritage society in Glasgow trying to preserve these magnificent buildings in the back streets, hidden, of course, behind soot and dirt and diesel oil and all the rest of it. What happened to Glasgow? It was overwhelmed by the horrors of the Industrial Revolution. It's overwhelmed by industry. It came so suddenly. First there was the tobacco and the tobacco lords. Then there was the cotton industry. And then coal and iron and steel. And all of that spawned the slums of Glasgow with their grinding poverty. And that geography gave people loving hearts and compassionate hearts. And they pulled together. That's why there's a conviviality about the people in the southwest of Scotland. I didn't care for it first when I went to Lanarkshire. I'm not awfully fond of people who are too convivial and friendly. I always feel they're after my money. You know, when they do eager to shake hands and slap your back and offer you a drink and rum and all the rest of it, I think, oh, he's after my money. I can see that, you see. That's the north suspiciousness, you see. But that warmth and loving kindness and meekness and tenderness was bred in them by the hardships of the slums in the Industrial Revolution. Geography breeds character. Character breeds history. And history breeds destiny. Can I give you two more examples, please? The United States of America, such a big country that you can see all of this operating as you move around. Geographies inside the geography. Up in the north, the New England states, descended from the Puritans, Dutch Reformed Church, Dutch Puritans with, well, in the 17th century, black clothes, you know, and faces that look like death warmed up, but not much. They are very cool, people in the north, the New England states. They speak about angular New Englanders. Rather severe, rather detached. Notice the last time I spoke up there, not a soul spoke to me at the end of the service. And I'd just come from the south, you see, from Texas, where they're all over you. You know, telling you your granny was born in Glasgow, and did I know Mary MacDonald from Glasgow. All that, you see, down in the south. All over you, see. All warm and open and altruistic and gushing and honey pie. But up north, rather cool. Don't take much notice of people. Very, 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 very detached. Geographies, you see. Breeding character. You go to the west coast, completely different. The west coast is a polyglot. Every nation under the sun lives in the west coast. America, you've got Polynesians and folk from Hawaii. There are Russians and Czechs and Slavs and Poles. You get Germans and Chinese and Japanese. They all have their own restaurants. Los Angeles, San Francisco, just a polyglot. It's hardly a culture at all. Like Belgium. Belgium's hardly a culture. Trying to be French and it's trying to be Flemish at the same time, and it's sort of nothing in between. But it's the geography that puts the character into the people. A last illustration, Mediterranean culture. What's the difference between the culture around the Mediterranean and the culture in Scandinavia? Well, Mediterranean culture is soft. South of France, Rome, Florence, Brindisi, Sicily, Malta, soft. Soft landscapes, soft colours. You think everything's been painted in pastel colours. Sort of soft pink and a soft blue, soft ochres. The very green of the fields is a soft, dusty green. A soft culture. The gods of Rome and Greece were soft gods. They were useless gods. They couldn't save you. They were just human beings blown up, having parties on Mount Olympus. Corrupt, rotten gods, like the men who worshipped them. Corrupt and rotten, soft-centered. When the crisis of life came, these gods couldn't help. But you see, in Scandinavia, culture is hard. Rocks, trees, the sea, hardship. And the gods of Scandinavia were hard gods. Thor, god of thunder. Gods of electricity. Woden, after whom Wednesday is named. God of wood. Gods of steel. Old Vulcan at the heart of his earth with his smiddy banging the anvil at the heart of the earth. That's what they move. That's what the Scandinavians believed, you see. Hard gods. The sort of hard culture that you find in Orkney and Shetland. You know, no trees, barren, windswept, the wind always blowing up north. And the geography has made the character. Can you fight against your destiny? Well, I think not really. Turn to the book of Acts in closing. Why has God put you in the house you live in the street you live in the town you live in the Highlands of Scotland? Well, Paul tells us, why did God put these tribes in those places? Why did he put one in the hills, one in the plain, one in the Jordan, one in the desert? Why? Well, this is from Paul's great sermon to the Athenians in Acts chapter 17. So Paul, verse 22, standing in the middle of the Areopagus, that's Mars Hill, is its other name, Ares, was the Greek for Mars. Mars is his Latin name. Ares was his Greek name. In the middle of the Areopagus said, "Men of Athens, I perceive that in every way you're very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God." Didn't know the God's name. They said their prayers to a God they didn't know. "What therefore you worship is unknown, this I proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it, being Lord of heaven and earth, does not live in shrines made by man, nor is he served by human hands, as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all men life and breath and everything." This great verse. "He has made from one every nation of men to live on all the face of the earth, having determined allotted seasons and the boundaries of their habitation." As he's put men, he's set us where we are, to live where we are, but read on, "that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel after him and find him. And yet, he's not far from each one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your poets have said." Now pick up the words from verses 26 and 27. God has made men and has appointed the boundaries of their habitation in order that they should seek God. Why do you live where you live, in the house where you live? Why has God put you in that house, in that street, in this town, in the Highlands? To seek God and enter your destiny. That's the second great lesson of this chapter. With all the tribes, the geography shaping their characters, the character shaping their history, the history shaping their everlasting destiny. The call is under God to enter our destiny wherever God has set us. Amen. May God bless His own word.